The Beanstalk has recused from our first case 20230069AO, Dr. Lamb.
Dr. Hero, would you like to do roll call first?
Yeah, please. Sorry. Thank you about that. Go ahead and get started.
Hero?
Yes.
Beanstalk, we know it's going to be late. Berg? Christensen?
Yes.
Thank you. Dinar?
Present.
Elgindy?
Here.
Goodman?
Virtually present.
Moffitt?
Here.
Morrow?
Here.
Pena?
Here.
And Seaman?
Here.
Thank you.
Great. Close to a full house. Thank you again, everybody, for accommodating this meeting. I know evenings and short notice meetings aren't easy, and it's appreciated by everyone. And thanks to board staff as well. So moving on to conflicts of interest, I'll open it up to the board to state any. Looks like we're good. Then agenda item 3A1, case number 20230069, Dr. Lamb. Ryan, would you, Dr. Lamb and Dr. D'Souza, are you both on with us right now?
Yes, sir.
Great. Ryan, would you swear both doctors in for me?
So I'm going to do the swearing in, and then I'll take a IV from Dr. Lamb first and then Dr. Souza second so that we can get it recorded. So go ahead and raise your right hand. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? We'll go with Derek Lamb first.
Yes.
And then Dr. D'Souza.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Hero.
Thank you, and thank you both for being here. Dr. Lamb, is your attorney with us as well, Mr. Goodwin?
Yes, he is.
Great. Mr. Goodwin, did you want to make any kind of opening statement?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
All right. I will keep it brief. I first want to confirm that I sent some literature into the board, and I know it's short notice, but, of course, this is an expedited hearing. I hope you are all able to read that. I'll be focused on why we submitted that literature to you in my brief comments here in the beginning. The first thing I want to point out is that the expert hired by the board has five primary criticisms, and we'll go over those to varying degrees of detail in my portion of this, but Dr. Lamb is really who you want to hear from, so that's who's going to be answering those five allegations in more detail. And, of course, he'll be ready to answer questions of you if you have any. So I'll just begin with the first criticism of the board's expert. The board's expert believes that the consent was invalid because the patient had smoked cannabis earlier that morning. We submitted some literature on specifically that point. The purpose in submitting the literature that we sent in really was just to illustrate for the board that there is no standard of care yet on the usage of marijuana when it comes to these issues. And I think anybody who purports to believe that there is an established standard of care is simply mistaken. It's just too new of a legal phenomenon here in Arizona and in many states across the country for there to be an established standard of care. And the literature that we submitted supports that. There was a sample informed consent form that we submitted. I know it's from Canada, but it basically is just talking about the fact that there are different timelines that different providers give to how long marijuana may be in somebody's system and how that may impact the informed consent process. There's another article on marijuana usage and impaired driving. And I will tell you my experience in that realm harkens back clear to 1997 when I was a prosecutor down in Tucson. We had to use special trained police officers to try and prove cases of impairment, and they were so weak and so hard to even contemplate getting in front of a jury that we just didn't prosecute them. And that's still true today. That's what the article is essentially telling you when it comes to marijuana impaired driving. And in effect, when police officers who are trained to look for signs and symptoms of impairment can't even do that without advanced training, and when prosecutors don't even rely upon it, I think that gives you some sense of how marijuana usage is just different than alcohol usage and other drugs. And so there's an article on that point in particular. It talks about impairment levels and how long impairment lasts, but basically at the end of the day, it says you have to use your judgment. The board's expert also, not in his listing of five criticisms, but elsewhere in his report, implied that he believes there's a 72-hour waiting standard of care. He said in one of his comments that the case should have been canceled and there should have been a delay of 72 hours. Well, I don't know how many of the practitioners here have patients who have informed them that they have used marijuana, but people who use marijuana for medical purposes or chronically, they can't stop that for 72 hours. It's prescribed medication for many of these people. So you have to adapt to that reality too, and there is no 72-hour standard of care. We submitted a document from the ASRA. It's the pain medicine consensus. It had a bunch of different issues that they were analyzing, but one of them basically was, is there any timeline that you should have here to delay cases? And there's no consensus on that. The next alleged deviation from the standard of care in the board's expert's report was there's an increased risk of complications due to cannabis usage, and that Dr. Lamb should have considered that. Well, Dr. Lamb's going to explain his response to that, but his response will be that he did consider it. And I think it's improper for the board's expert to just assume that he didn't. Maybe it wasn't highlighted in the documentation, but this is Dr. Lamb's first opportunity to explain to you what he did and did not consider. And he did indeed know that this patient had consumed marijuana, and he did indeed consider it when he decided whether to proceed. The third issue that is in the expert's report is that Dr. Lamb didn't adjust the medications to account for the heightened risk of airway complications in this patient. I'm going to have Dr. Lamb explain his response to that, and he'll give you his thought process there. The fourth issue is that the expert believes that Dr. Lamb failed to halt the procedure at the start of complication, and he proceeded to use a local anesthetic and should not have done so. In this instance, I think that's a classic case of hindsight being 20/20. It's always easy to second guess things when you know the outcome. Dr. Lamb's going to explain to you what was going on at the time that he administered the local, and I think he'll verify that this patient didn't have significant warning signs on the horizon, nothing separating this patient at that point in time from a whole host of other patients. And so he felt comfortable proceeding with the local anesthetic, and he'll explain his thought process on that point. Finally, the board's retained expert opines that the medications administered and their sequence contributed to the adverse outcome. And one of the issues that I was asking Dr. Lamb earlier, and what I would ask the board to consider, is I don't know if an autopsy has been done. I don't know if there's any indication or evidence before this board of an official finding of what caused this patient's death. But that would be something that would be important, I think, to factor in if we're talking about the belief that this was a medication error. The board's expert was focused on the midazolam and the fentanyl and the fact that Dr. Lamb only administered flumazenil as a reversal agent. So one of the articles that we submitted was one that basically indicates that you can effectively use flumazenil in this setting, and it effectively reverses ventilatory depression. The board's expert also opined that the incorrect dose of flumazenil was administered. He opined that more than double the dose was administered. The last article of literature that I submitted to the board on that point indicates that giving 0.5 milligrams, just as Dr. Lamb did, is appropriate in this context. I believe the board's expert is a dental anesthesiologist. And we went to the American Dental Society of Anesthesiology and downloaded their app. They have an app called 10 Minutes to Save a Life. Using that app, you can input certain data about your patient, and it will give you an indication of what dosages of medications to give in certain settings. And lo and behold, 0.5 of flumazenil is indicated in this setting. The reason I bring that point up at the very end here is I've been before this board before making the argument that a dental anesthesiologist should not be opining about the standard of care of an oral maxillofacial surgeon. And I know that the board does not agree with me on that. But I think the board acts to its peril under Arizona state law, in particular, the published opinions out there. I know there is a pathway to use experts in other areas of expertise when there's an overlap in their skill set, but I submit to you that you're on safer ground if you have the same field of expertise reviewing the same person that you're assessing their care. So I believe that when you have an expert who is a dental anesthesiologist and their own society is giving advice that is different than what this expert put in their report, that simply illustrates that different people can have different opinions about new standards of care. And this is an evolving standard of care when we're talking about marijuana usage. I submit to you that different fields of anesthesiology, practitioners out there, don't agree with each other on this point. So I don't think relying upon one person to identify the standard of care in so many of the settings that are set forth in this expert's report is appropriate. And I appreciate the fact that you're allowing Dr. Lamb to give you his thought process, and I'll turn it over to him at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodwin. Dr. Lamb, before you start, can we just make a note that Dr. Beanstock joined the meeting at 6.03 p.m., but is currently recused. Go ahead, Dr. Lamb.
Thank you for your time. And, yes, I do just really kind of want to echo what James or Mr. Goodwin had said regarding what happened. He and I have discussed the case thoroughly, and, you know, the points that he made about a patient not being able to give consent, I think, is invalid. He was alert. I believe that he drove to the appointment. We met with him. He was talking normally. No evidence that he was impaired in any way. And I did consider the fact that he had smoked marijuana that morning. We do, you know, when patients do present that way, we kind of know what to expect, that they're going to require more medications, just being a marijuana smoker. They are going to have more irritable airways, more salivary secretions. And, so, I mean, we just sort of prepare for that. We know what to expect. And, I mean, that's what we had planned for this patient. A couple of other things, the investigator did, he criticized my use of my election of ketamine to use in the anesthetic because it also does create, you know, increased salivation as well. But ketamine is something that we do use in smokers, including those with marijuana, because it does preserve respiratory function. It also does bronchodilate. And so for the respiratory issues, that's one of the reasons why I would use it in this particular patient. You know, with regard to the fact where he stated that I didn't stop the procedure when he experienced respiratory distress and I just continued to give local anesthesia, is incorrect because, when patients, you induce the anesthesia many times, you know, their airway and everything is going to relax. They do obstruct a little bit, and then we're able to usually adjust the jaw, pull the tongue out, and we get airflow. And that is what happened at that point, and that's why I was comfortable proceeding with the administration of the local anesthesia. It was shortly after the local anesthesia was administered that we did start to see more severe respiratory distress, and where he was having more difficulty breathing, and we started to have more difficulty keeping him oxygenated at that point. As far as the reversal agent, I did give flumazenil to try and reverse the anesthetic, he still had on board ketamine. He also had propofol. He did not wake up, and he was not breathing on his own. He still had the distressed, obstructed breathing that he had shortly after we administered the local anesthesia. And that is why I decided to give him succinylcholine and propofol to try to deepen the anesthesia again, because I was suspicious that he was still having a laryngospasm and he was not breathing well. We then, you know, attempted to continue to help him breathe or assist his breathing with a bag valve mask, and had a little success, but not that much. Ultimately, my plan was to insert a more invasive airway, and I was going to go for an LMA, but that was when paramedics and firefighters showed up in my office.
Thank you, doctor. Dr. Nishant, are you logged in with us?
Hi, Dr. Hero. Good evening. I'm here.
Good evening. Thank you for being here. Is there, you want to give us, you know, kind of any kind of brief recap that wasn't already mentioned as far as the potential violations that you found or anything you want to add?
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond. Is this also an opportunity to respond to the remarks from Dr. Lamb and his attorney, or do you just want to recap on the case?
No, you can offer a response, and then Dr. Lamb, we'll give you and Mr. Goodwin a chance to kind of close with whatever statement you want to make after Dr. Nishant makes his comments.
So the one of the first allegations that I made in my report was the consent being invalid. And in my experience, when a patient is impaired, they're not in the right state of mind to sign a consent. And in my experience in institutions, hospitals, and in private practice, you know, we judge their impairment to the case at hand. And in this instance, the patient was presenting for an elective procedure of implant placement in the mandible. And that elective procedure just doesn't justify making any accommodations to the patient's ability to accurately consent or their level of impairment. They smoked marijuana that morning. Marijuana affects you for several hours. The patient was seen in the morning. It's reasonable to consider that there was some level of impairment, even though he was able to drive to the appointment and talked normally. One of the things that Mr. Goodwin stated was the ability to adjust medications, especially when prescribed, is not something that you're able to do. Typically in those situations, what most providers would do is consult with the person who prescribed the medications and see if there's an opportunity to make an accommodation there, and then rely on that physician's report in order to adjust the medications that are prescribed. In the journal articles that I submitted with my original report, there are several options available to patients who are chronically using cannabis. And one of those could have been considered here if the patient was taking cannabis for pain in the 72-hour period leading up to the appointment. An alternative pain medication could have been administered, or if the patient was taking cannabis for anxiety, an alternative anxiety medication could have been administered. And those medications, in my experience, would have led to a more predictable anesthetic. And that's really the nature of the cannabis issue. Mr. Goodwin and Dr. Lamb both referenced the new components or the new aspect of cannabis in the treatment of anesthesia. And they're right. It is new. But the literature at this point is overwhelming on what the effects of cannabis are. And there's numerous case reports of anesthesia being extremely difficult in patients who are utilizing cannabis. Like Dr. Lamb mentioned, their tolerance to medications is extremely high. And their reaction during the procedure, their ability to breathe well is very challenging because of the secretions. And what that means specifically is, you know, in the open airway anesthesia technique that Dr. Lamb was utilizing, which is appropriate for the oral surgery setting, and that's what I do when I see my oral surgery patients in the office, the patient is breathing on their own, and they're moving air on their own like they normally would. It's just that they're unconscious or deeply sedated when they're doing that. the problem with secretions like saliva is that it collects in the mouth and an excess amount of it develops, and it literally, they drown in their own saliva. Like they try to inhale it and the body develops a protective reflex called the laryngospasm, where it tries to seal off the airway to prevent saliva from going down into the trachea and into the lungs. And like Dr. Lamb suspects, there was a laryngospasm here, and I agree with him there. And the dilemma that I have is I don't think that there was adequate preparation or planning done in anticipation of this patient. For instance, and this is ubiquitous amongst dental providers across the board who administer anesthesia, if you're anticipating a high amount of secretions, you would do two very reasonable things that all levels of anesthesia providers are trained, regardless of me being an anesthesiologist or an oral surgeon. And that would be to, one, don't give something that increases secretions when you're expecting a lot of secretions. And two, to use a medication like glycopyrrolate or atropine, a subtherapeutic prophylactic dose at the beginning of the case, that would help prevent secretions from forming. And Dr. Lamb states that he prepared and he planned for the case, but those medications were not administered until later on in the procedure when an emergency had developed. So I disagree that there was preparing and planning that was performed here. I think that Dr. Lamb administered a very typical standard oral surgery technique for sedation that most oral surgeons administer in my experience. And I disagree that ketamine was a good choice here. The jaw thrust, the holding of the tongue out of the mouth in order to improve the airway when the patient became obstructive after he was sedated. And obstructive means that they're not passing air very well into their lungs and saturating adequately or ventilating CO2. The problem that I have with that, and I don't know if you guys have your board packet handy or not, but if you look at page 72 of that packet, you'll see the patient's driver's license. And I was going to pull that up here, and unfortunately my computer just closed it out. So give me just a moment and I'll pull that up.
We can't show patient's full name at a public meeting that's recorded. But we have the packet in front of us, so you can refer to the page and we can look at it.
The page is 79.
Ah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diner and Ms. Diner.
Okay, 79. You look at the patient, and what I see is a middle-aged male. We see his height at 6 feet and 210 pounds. And it looks to me like he has a very muscular build. He has a prominent forehead. He has a very thick neck. He's got shoulders that are up like this. You know, if you put that patient in front of me and I evaluated them, I would consider that patient to be a difficult airway right off the bat and a difficult open airway case, regardless of even the cannabis use or the way that he presented, just airway alone. It's going to be a difficult patient to manage. Why? Well, you can't do a very good chin lift to open the airway because he's got a thick neck. There's just tissue back there. And you're not going to be able to do an adequate jaw thrust to move his jaw forward and open his airway because he's just got a very muscular build. You just don't have the ability to move the mandible like that. And it tells me right off the bat that he's going to be a difficult airway patient. And questionable to do a deep sedation open airway technique on that patient. So you take the cannabis use that already complicates anesthesia severely. You take the patient's presentation with a difficult airway, and you just have this combination that results in an outcome where you're very likely to have an adverse event or a breathing complication present. Further along, Dr. Lamb mentioned the medications that were administered and the dosage of flumazenil. I'm going off of the dosage in the package insert, the manufacturer's recommended dosage that's approved by the FDA. And the dosage that was administered was double the amount in the package insert. My point there is not to say that it's wrong, because in some instances and in some algorithms, you do preemptively administer a higher dose because you want to very quickly and rapidly reverse the patient's sedation. And the trade-off there is you don't want to have to do two doses, especially if you're doing a sublingual or an intramuscular dose, because you need that medicine to have a strong effect right away. On the flip side, a higher dosage like that can have side effects, seizures, patients becoming very upset or combative. But it's better to have a patient that is alive and upset or having a seizure that can be managed than to be unable to manage an airway. Now, in Dr. Lamb's position, he's trained in general anesthesia and deep sedation. So I don't know that I can justify going to a higher dose of flumazenil right off the bat, because if it wasn't adequate initially, he should have still been able to ventilate or manage the patient's airway. And the problem here is that the root cause is that he wasn't able to do that. At the end of the case, what I read in Dr. Lamb's notes is that things were getting very out of hand. And he reversed the patient, and the patient was moving in the chair and combative. I find it difficult to understand how an asleep patient was being combative in a purposeful kind of way. You know, he had administered the reversal. The medications that had been given up to this point, in my experience, caring for patients of a similar background in a similar setting with a similar anesthetic technique, the medications administered up to that point really just weren't adequate, in my opinion, to fully anesthetize a patient. And then a reversal was given. My opinion is genuinely that the patient was moving purposefully when he was combative. And when the succinylcholine was administered, the patient was likely reacting to that medication. And I don't think it was necessary at that point. I'm just going to point out two things, and then I'll stop there, is that backing up a little bit, Dr. Lamb stated just now that when he did the jaw thrust and he maneuvered the tongue out of the mouth with gauze, he deemed that the airway was adequate to proceed with local anesthetic. But when I read his notes in the board packet, the notes say that those maneuvers only yielded a mild improvement to his airway. Well, if it was only a mild improvement, why did you move forward? It's just not justified, in my opinion. And regarding the end of the case, when the succinylcholine was administered, Dr. Lamb was concerned that the patient was still in a laryngospasm and not ventilating. But his notes say that his breathing was noisy. And if a patient's not moving air, if they're not exchanging anything, it can't be noisy. So I disagree that the patient was still in a laryngospasm at the end of the case when he was combative and moving around and almost knocked over the chair. That's it.
Thank you, Dr. Michon. Appreciate it. Dr. Lamb, Mr. Goodwin, would you like to offer a response to that before we move forward?
This is Jim. I'll just offer a couple comments. I guess on that last point about what is written in Dr. Lamb's summary versus what he said here today versus what the board's expert believes happened, I just would like the board to consider the reality here that we're talking about an emergency situation that happened very quickly. And the focus of everybody in that room was on the patient, not on documentation and reconstructing things later on. The written word is never going to capture everything exactly right. This question and answer session that you're having here today probably gets you closer to the truth. But I feel like sometimes experts just make assumptions about what occurred without really knowing what happened because they were not there. And that's not their fault. That's just a reality of the situation. So I would encourage you that if the board has more questions following what your expert commented on, please do ask Dr. Lamb for clarification, because I don't want you to just assume that an expert who wasn't there is reconstructing things accurately from what we wrote and what we've said so far. I also want to emphasize the fact that even though the board's expert just pointed out that when he's talking about the dosage of flumazenil, he's getting that from the package insert. And at one point he said, it's not his point to say that the dose that Dr. Lamb gave is wrong, but in truth, that's really what he says in his report. And he seems to backtrack here today, now that we pointed out that there are sources out there, published literature and groups, that agree with the 0.5 dosage of flumazenil. So again, I just want to caution the board to not assume that one person's testimony here before you is indeed the standard of care, when their own testimony backtracked here today from what they wrote in their report. So those are the two things that I really wanted to kind of focus on in responding to your expert, and I'll let Dr. Lamb add anything that he wants to, and we'll turn it back over to you. So thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Lamb, anything to add?
I basically stated everything that I felt and that I believed, and I don't believe that things that I did were below the standard of care. I think I followed the protocol that you would do for, you know, what you think is a laryngospasm. And in the end, do we know that he really had a laryngospasm? I'm not sure.
Thank you, doctor. So I've got just a couple questions, and then I'll open it up to the rest of the board to ask Dr. Lamb you some questions as well, if that's okay with you.
Yes.
First, I want to thank you for signing the interim consent agreement. I think, you know, that cooperation always shows that a licensee is willing to be regulated, willing to work with us, and I think that that's important to note and to recognize by the board. To Mr. Goodwin's comment about Dr. Nishant, our consultant, being an anesthesiologist, and Dr. Lamb being an oral surgeon, I do think it's important to note that they have the exact same permit. They both have 1301 permits that both allow them to do the same type of anesthesia in the same setting. You want to comment on that, Dr. Lamb, at all?
It cut out. I didn't hear what you said.
There hasn't been any conversation regarding the potential violation of the expired ACLS. Any comment on that?
I mean, that was something that it was sort of an oversight that we, you know, I let it lapse, and you know, I have no excuse for that. You know, I have set up in my office now to where my office manager is monitoring it, and she's going to make sure that we all have all of our certifications at least prepared to be finished at least 3 months in advance of their expiration date.
And Mr. Goodwin had commented that it was an emergency situation that happened quickly. Certainly, I'm sure that's the case. Given that ACLS is geared towards handling emergency situations like this, and you are not current with that, do you think, had you been current, the outcome would have been different at all?
No, I don't.
Okay. And I believe this patient had been sedated in your office previously. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you know just approximately how long before this occurrence was the last sedation?
Yes, it was in November of 2022.
Which would have been just a few months.
Yes.
Three, 4 months. How did he do with that anesthesia appointment?
I mean, he didn't have any issues.
And was the technique similar that you employed?
It was similar, and he was a bit more nervous, I recall. And I chose to use diazepam as part of my anesthetic regimen, and but we didn't have any problems.
Okay, thank you, doctor. That's the only questions I have for Dr. Lamb. So, board members, I'll open it up to you. Dr. Christensen, I'm sure the board wants to hear from you on this one, given that you're also an oral surgeon. So, not to put you on the spot, but to put me on the spot, I'd like to make any comments or have any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Hero. Thank you, Dr. Lamb, for being here, and Mr. Goodwin and Deshaunt for your review. I've certainly had some concerns about the review, and felt there was some issues there when I looked at it concerning the cannabis intake. That's the reality of the world that we live in, the state that we live in. It's legalized. There's legal use of it. There's also recreational use and illicit use, for that matter. And our chronic pain patients are frequently using that. We have chronic pain patients that are on narcotics regularly, daily, that come in and consent to do procedures every day in our office. So that was one concern that I had there, that, you know, somebody that could get to go to the office. They'd been there before, potentially paid for their procedure that day, knowing what they were going to have done. So the fact that the fact that Dr. Lamb asked about this and actually knew, when that had taken place, I think it shows that he was, you know, preparing, and they were astute to that potential use. Some of the other things that I had was, you know, oftentimes, and you know, local anesthetics also administer to stimulate breathing and things of that nature. So provide a local anesthetic in a stimulatory fashion as well, to get somebody that maybe isn't breathing as regular as they should is something that is used daily in a surgeon's office. As far as the increase in secretions, ketamine's used daily in my office. I know it's used in many offices as an oral and maxillofacial surgeon. We understand that there are secretions that can increase with that administration. That's why we do have throat packs and suctioning. Laryngospasms can happen regardless of ketamine use or hypersalivation. I mean, just the fact of having, you know, some heme hit the cords, you can come across these laryngospasms. I think just understanding my office, you know, they are prepared to manage difficult airways. We see them all the time as well in our office, with jaw thrusts and additional techniques. I went through what Dr. Lamb had done, responding to the emergency protocols. I mean, the flunazenil, in an emergency situation, whether you're giving 0.2 or 0.3 or 0.45, I think that's, not the point. And never had an ill effect on the outcome of what had happened. He did put an adjunctive airway in to help manage the airway with a nasopharyngeal airway. He did try to deepen the sedation to try to break the laryngospasm, which is a technique used. The medications that were administered prior, they were all within a typical limit, considering the individual. It's just a really unfortunate situation that happened. And the question is, do we know everything that's happened? Do we have a full scope of what, you know, I know they talked about, you know, as far as what the patient had taken, and do we have a full understanding of anything else that may have played into what happened that day? And I think that's still a question that is out there, and hopefully we'll add some additional information to what took place.
Thank you, Dr. Christensen. And you know, you actually, your last comment brought up a question I forgot to ask you, Dr. Lamb. When you hear a patient smoke marijuana before surgery, do you inquire if they've taken anything else? And I ask that because that's, you know, it's something that comes to my mind when we interview our patients for anesthesia in our practice is oftentimes, I know marijuana is legal here now, but it traditionally was always a question that would, if they were taking marijuana, we would almost presume maybe they're taking something else. And so it would spark a conversation about if they do take any other illegal substances, or any illegal substances. And I was curious if that was a conversation you had had.
Yes. I mean, we ask if they take any recreational drugs or illicit substances. We do that with every patient that we sedate and put to sleep.
Okay. Do you ever work with a second provider, like a nurse anesthetist or dental anesthesiologist?
Occasionally. Lately I have been, but typically I don't very often.
And at the time you didn't feel that this was a case that would have warranted a second provider?
No, I did not.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Diner.
Thank you, Dr. Hero, and thank you, Dr. Lam, for being here. I have a few questions. So you had seen this patient in November of 2022, and then you saw him again. In November, were you aware of the patient's marijuana use?
No, I was not. I don't see it any documented in our chart. So.
Okay. And if you had been aware at that point, would your approach to treatment have changed the second time that you gave treatment?
If I had known, that he had done it in November, or?
This patient was just a frequent user of marijuana.
Because everything seemed to go smoothly in November, I wouldn't have changed it.
So I'm asking these questions because the consultant had mentioned something about alternatives to marijuana for handling whatever symptoms the patient had. And my understanding is some of these other medications that would treat anxiety or, some other conditions might need to be titrated up. And I don't think it's the dentist's job to it's not the dentist's standard of care to sort of counsel the patient to get those alternatives to marijuana from their general practitioner or whatever, psychiatrist or whoever. So could you speak to that point that the consultant raised?
If they are using it for pain, anxiety, yes, there is literature that supports you should reduce the amount and see if you can stop it days before. I didn't, I just assumed that he was probably using it for anxiety, and I didn't really give that a whole lot of consideration, to be honest.
Thank you. That's all my questions for now.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. Ms. Penna.
Thank you. Dr. Lam, thank you very much for being here. I have a question. On page 68, I'm wondering who the witness was, who signed the consent form.
That would have been one of my assistants. I don't have the pages here.
Okay, so if you think the patient is in a healthy enough state to go ahead, is it possible that your assistant would ever say, Dr. Lam, stop, I'm not going to sign?
Absolutely, yes.
My
assistants, they have no fear in telling me if they feel something's not right.
Okay, thank you. One other question. If you were to do this over again and have this same patient again, what would you do differently?
Knowing what had happened?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I would have delayed the surgery.
Until when?
That there's no clear guidelines regarding that. So.
Okay.
I don't know. Just knowing that something terrible and traumatic happened there. I don't know. I would have never even wanted to do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Goodwin, or Goodman.
Yeah, you can call me Nick, Dr. Hero, to cut down on any confusion. Appreciate you being here today, Dr. Lam, and of course, it's a very serious matter and an issue. I'm a public board member. I run a medical group, so I only know enough words to get myself in trouble, but I don't actually know how to do any of it. One of the things that really stood out to me is that the patient was resedated. In your experience, whether it's training or since training, how often is that the case that somebody is brought up and then back into sedation?
I've never had to do that.
Have you observed it done, like back in training? Did you see it happen where others were doing it?
I've never seen where someone was reversed and then resedated, no.
Is it part of formal training for anesthesia?
What part?
Resedating.
I mean, if a patient is becoming light and they need to be sedated again, then yes.
Okay, so, some of the board members could weigh in for me as well, but I'm trying to understand if there's any standard or structure where somebody's brought up and then put back into sedation in that type of way, or if that's something that the person doing anesthesia going into the case would say, oh, I might end up pulling them up and then pushing them back down into sedation.
I mean, I guess the only thing I can think of that being a possibility is if an instrument or a gauze is not found and, you know, you need to look for it, and the patient needs to stay asleep, then perhaps, but.
Okay. All right. But not a lot of experience for you with that. Can you give any insight on the decision? The combativeness of the patient sounds like it was part of it, but the decision to resedate?
Yeah, because he was not breathing well. He was making the same noise that he made, you know, basically after I gave the local anesthesia. It sounded like he was obstructed and the air was just not flowing through.
Okay, so you gave the recovery as he was supposed to be recovering. The airway sounded the same, so you sedated him again?
Yes, because his oxygenation was dropping. He was deteriorating. And so I felt I had to do something to try and make sure that we could get him oxygenated.
Okay. All right. And on my part, it really is more trying to understand it. I'll leave it to the other clinicians on the board to probably help on that. I do have another question or two. We were presented information from your attorney. Why a consent form from Canada? Are you aware why that was chosen? And maybe your attorney could help us with that.
Sorry, this is Jim. I'll weigh in on that. I had to find the form real quick and then find the mute button. Basically, the part that I focused on personally was the patient was agreeing to wait 4 hours after smoking cannabis, 6 hours after taking a cannabinoid orally, or 8 hours after feeling high before driving or operating heavy machinery or signing legal documents. So this patient smoked. The Canadian consent form is saying don't go out and drive, sign legal documents or operate heavy machinery until you wait at least 4 hours. And that's approximately how long this patient waited after smoking and then before having his surgery. My point really is not to say that's the standard of care. It's to point out that there's no consensus on what the standard of care is. And different countries even think different ways, but it's the same medication and people are people.
Okay. I'll tell you how I interpret it. It looks to me like it's a very convenient argument, and the data fit your story. So you shared with us information, and you don't have to answer that other than, had you found something out of Canada that was 6 hours after smoking, we probably would have never seen it. On the actual consent, this is for Dr. Lamb. Why isn't there more about cannabis in your consent?
It hasn't been something that has been a major issue for us.
So, although three times as much propofol, things of that nature are understood with sedation, because you haven't had an adverse occurrence, you don't have it as a key part of your consent.
I mean, we tell patients that they do require, you know, if they are marijuana users, they do have higher requirements. There are definitely more issues with them. I mean, I just don't have anything written on the informed consent about it.
Okay. All right. Appreciate that. And then I'm definitely okay with the attorney having a response to this or not, up to you. But Mr. Goodwin, you shared the argument that because police have a hard time determining whether somebody's high on marijuana, therefore there's not a good standard in medicine. But in this case, we don't have to determine whether the patient used marijuana. The patient disclosed it, and it was part of the choices that Dr. Lamb made. So trying to understand that a little bit more, where you're sharing that logic with us and kind of maybe where you're wanting us to go with that, because to me, we don't need to prove whether the patient used marijuana. The patient disclosed it and it was taken into account.
That's a good question. And I do need to clarify. I'm not talking about marijuana usage. I'm talking about impairment. You can use marijuana, you can use alcohol, you can use any prescribed narcotic drugs just fine. And these medical providers have to adapt to those patients every time they come in and report using those medications. One of the ways that they have to adapt is they have to figure out whether the patient is impaired to a degree that they cannot sign an informed consent and understand what they're getting into. In my line of work, in litigation, informed consent is talked about, but I have never seen a case where it changed the outcome or had any impact. Because basically the patient has to say that if they had been told something or understood something differently, they would not have had the procedure at all. And that's pretty hard to prove and pretty hard to understand. I know why you guys think it's very important, and I agree with you. My point is it's very challenging to evaluate impairment based simply upon the knowledge of usage without knowing how chronic the patient uses, how much it impacts them personally, what type of medication they used, what they ate at the time they used, what they drank, what other medications they may have had. So basically you're asking somebody to act as a police officer when my point earlier on is when you're talking about marijuana, even police officers with all of their training have a hard time determining impairment. They can find out usage just by asking, just like Dr. Lamb did.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Dr. Hira, those are all my questions for this time.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it. Any other board members have any questions or comments?
Hi, Dr. Lamb. This is Dr. Morrow. Sorry, Dr. Al-Gandhi. I'll hurry. We had a board member ask about if you'd make a choice that would be different, and you made the choice of not doing the case, and I want to give you one more hypothetical, and then you tell me what your thoughts are. If you chose to do the case again and you got into it, would you have done anything differently if you were in the middle of the case? How would you have handled it any different?
No.
Okay. Second, what was the determining factor of if you were going to continue on with the procedure or not? What would have been the determining factor in that? Because you got to give another set of anesthetic, I would assume, to continue with the treatment.
At what point are you talking about?
So you said you gave an anesthetic after you gave anesthetic a second time?
After the reversal agent?
Yep. To continue with the procedure, I would assume, right?
No, this was to try to get him oxygenated.
Okay. So was there any point where you were thinking, hey, this is a good idea to continue with the procedure, or were we just trying to get him to breathe?
Once he started struggling with breathing, that was my main focus, was just to keep him oxygenated.
Okay. Mr. Goodman asked a whole bunch of good questions, but at the same time, I think that I think Eddie answered a couple of those as well with bringing the patient back under and stuff like that as well. So I, as far as the consent for me under cannabis, there's written consent and then there's implied consent. Implied consent also is at the time of treatment plan. You've already treatment planned him and you've done work on him recently. So at that point, he's understood the risks. Oftentimes you're using the same consent form even. For the case you did a few months before, was it the same consent form, same procedure type?
The anesthesia consent was the same. The implant versus extraction, those are a little bit different, but they're essentially the same.
So those are the thoughts going through my head, President Hero. That's all I got.
Yeah, and part of the reason I asked about the procedure done in November was because he had consented a few months prior to that for the exact same procedure. The treatment plan would have been reviewed between then and the procedure. So the consent portion of this didn't bother me as much as other areas. Dr. Ogedi, did you have your hand up?
Actually, Dr. Morrow asked the question, so I'm good.
Okay. I think as a point of clarification, and Eddie, you know, re-clarify this if I misstate anything, but I think there's some questions about the resedation portion of it. What I understand is the patient was in airway distress. Dr. Lamb gave reversal agents for the drugs that have reversal agents. For those that he, you know, the other propofol, ketamine have no reversal agent. After the airway didn't improve, after Versed and the narcotic were reversed, and the airway continued to be a problem, it's appropriate to give a dose of propofol and sux to try to break the laryngospasm and insert an advanced airway. So I don't think this was a scenario where, you know, he wanted to wake the patient up and then decided to put the patient back to sleep. I think it all had to do with trying to gain control. You know, patient's moving around, airway is not established. To give a dose of propofol and a dose of succinylcholine to reestablish that airway and gain control is probably appropriate. In kind of the hypothetical situation, I guess I'm not saying in this situation for sure, but that the line of thinking makes sense to me. And I don't know if that helps some of the board members that had questions, but I wanted to restate that. Mr. Goodwin?
That's correct, Dr. Hero.
Thanks, Eddie.
Yeah, Dr. Hero, I guess that's where I think I'm understanding where you're going with it. The narrative very much sounded like because he was he had become agitated, that's why there was more sedation. And essentially what we're saying here is, no, it was all about the airway. Whether he was moving around or not, it was the airway we were trying to, that Dr. Lamb was trying to say.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of things, you know, can be going on all at once. And, you know, the primary thought is, I got to gain control of the situation. I got to get an airway. And so to administer what he administered at that point, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, hypothetical standpoint, probably makes sense. For me, what the issue is, you know, you had an elective procedure, office-based setting. Patient came in having used cannabis knowingly. At some point, the airway was lost and could not be reestablished, and the patient died. I think that, you know, is probably fair 30,000-foot view assessment. One other thing I would add to this, I guess a couple. One, the expiration of the ACLS, there's some issue with that, certainly. I mean, there's a reason why we are required to take them and why we are required to keep them current. Also, to the consultant's point of, was the anesthesia approach altered, knowing that the patient had used cannabis? You look at the record in November and you look at the record in March, almost identical. So it does seem as though, even though the patient came in with a drug in his system on the second visit, there was no alteration to the anesthesia plan. And something as simple as atropine or glycopyrrolate really could have been a difference maker had that been planned out from the beginning. So I think there are, you know, violations here. I think there's concern here that is going to require action. This is agendized for potential summary suspension. To that comment, I don't think there's a question here with Dr. Lamb's ability to provide surgery. So in my opinion, I wouldn't be seeking a summary suspension at this point. I think it's the violations and any action we take should really just be around the anesthesia permit, the 1301 permit, not his actual dental license. Mr. Diner.
So, Dr. Hero, maybe this is a question for you and Dr. Christensen. So I understood Dr. Christensen to say that even when a patient presents with recent marijuana use the day of the surgery, for example, it doesn't necessarily indicate that the anesthesia protocol needs to change. So I'm trying to understand why the identical nature of the drug protocol in the November sitting and the later sitting is relevant to our discussion.
You know, first I'll say I don't know that it really that it changes the outcome. It could, you know, it would, you know, say you had a patient that was on, if this patient was taking marijuana for pain, which it sounds like he probably wasn't, but in that scenario, if he were, and rather than it being marijuana for pain, it was oxycodone or OxyContin, and that patient came in, you are going to factor in that he's on a long-term narcotic and potentially alter your course of anesthesia, your anesthesia plan. Like our consultant stated, if cannabis is known to create extra secretion, you want to use ketamine, and I wouldn't fault Dr. Lamb for using ketamine. As Dr. Lamb mentioned, it's a bronchodilator. It's not a respiratory depressant. It's a great drug to use. But if you're using that drug, which is going to cause more secretions, and now you know there's a drug that also causes secretions, the next appropriate step would be give an auxiliary drug that's used all the time to minimize the secretion. Because there's a really, very real possibility here that the secretions caused a laryngospasm on a patient with a difficult airway. I totally agree with Dr. Nishant's assessment looking at the picture. The guy presents with a difficult airway. You want to do everything you can to mitigate the potential issue of a lost airway. I didn't see an alteration in a treatment in a anesthesia plan that took that into consideration. So that was why I was correlating the two. I don't know if that answers your question, Mr. Diner, but that's trying.
Thank you for the insight. I'm a public member, so you know all of this is very helpful to sort of formulate my thoughts. Thank you.
Sure. Ms. Pena.
One thing that has not been brought up is the amount of cannabis use and the amount of cannabis used the day of the incident, the amount of cannabis used at the prior appointment, what time it was used. So the time and the amount might create two vastly different situations, and maybe that was what caused two vastly different situations.
Certainly. I think, and I don't know that we have access to that information. I guess what I'm going to keep going back to is what we know. You know, we know there was some kind of there's some amount of cannabis in the system. We know the airway was lost. We know the airway could not be reestablished, and we know the patient expired. Whatever action I recommend is going to be based upon that. Nick, and then we'll go to you, Russ.
Wanted to clarify one thing. Dr. Hero, are we moving to the deliberation portion of our show, or are we
still open? The way this is agendized, we can deliberate, but we certainly can go back and ask questions.
Okay. All right. I don't have any specific questions. Just wanted to see where we were. I'm probably for you, Dr. Hero, maybe some of the other board members. Were there any other more drastic measures that could have been taken to help the patient, tracheotomy, things of that nature that may have, hindsight, of course, but may have resulted in a better outcome?
Well, it sounds like, the use of the paralytic, that the succinylcholine that he gave, was in preparation to break the laryngeal spasm and place a more advanced airway. He said he was going to grab an LMA. But then the paramedics arrived. So I think there was preparation at that point in time for that.
It is correct medically for him to allow the paramedics to take over. That's the right path, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Trying to understand, what could have happened. And then did have a comment, for Mr. Dinar. I think we see in medicine quite often where a surgeon will consult another care provider about medical amounts, treatments, things of that nature. You just had a question, some comment earlier around that, and it's very normal to say to the primary care doctor, hey, is this dosage aligned with this person having anesthesia? Just at least my experience, I see that often.
Right. I mean, I understand that. Sorry, Dr. Morrow, to skip over you, but to that point, I do understand that there is frequent communication between, healthcare providers. My point was that Dr. Lam did not know of marijuana usage in November. The first time he knew really was at the second surgery. So at that point, the day of the surgery, there really isn't, a lot of other things are happening. You're preparing, for the room for the surgery and everything else. You aren't going to speak to the other healthcare provider as to, well, why didn't you give an alternative to marijuana to treat anxiety or something else that some existing condition that the patient has. So in my opinion, I think it isn't the standard of care for dentists in that situation to then contact some other healthcare provider to get a change in medication. I mean, at that point, the patient has presented with a drug in their system, and we need to, decide as a dentist how to provide the care that we need to provide it in that moment. So that was my point. But thank you, Dr. Hey.
Dr. Moran.
One quick question to board staff. Is there any priors?
So, Dr. Morrow, this is Ryan. We can't establish any priors unless you establish a violation, and so you got to clarify on the record what the violation is first.
Got it. All right. So before we do that, then the biggest thing I see, and of course, we look at this so much closer because of the fatal outcome that happens. The problem with sedation is often sometimes there are negative effects that can happen to very healthy individuals. And that's the frustrating part on this. He's a young man, that could have been the direct relation to the death. Those kind of things really, weigh on us heavily, especially in dental, as members of the dental board. But the other thing that gets me is the ACLS, and really that's the biggest issue for me, Anthony, that I have is just the ACLS issues, because I think the sedation sounds reasonable and not, not overly aggressive and not underly treated. Is that reasonable, Dr. Christensen?
Well, let me jump in real quick, because yes, there's a greater risk when you're doing a sedation, deep anesthesia, general anesthesia, than a lot of other types of procedures that are done. But, and I understand, you know, kind of where you're coming from with this, Russ, but when you have a young, healthy adult male like this, this was an airway issue. And the airway issues, airways can be managed when intervened early on and appropriately. And there was an inability to do that here that resulted in the patient death.
Sure.
I don't want to sit back here and say, well, you know, people can die under anesthesia. It seems like everything was done okay. He died. So that's not the issue. I think had more appropriate, more skilled airway techniques been employed earlier on, the patient would have survived this. And even if there was something else in the system that we don't know, again, had that airway been managed, you know, we wouldn't have the outcome that we had. This, from everything we understand, it was not a cardiovascular event. At least, I mean, initially, it was an airway event. Had that been managed appropriately by the licensee, the outcome would have been avoided. So
I guess
I don't want to minimize that.
I guess I was asking about the drugs. Was the path and the pattern, it wasn't unreasonable. The actual hands-on component, absolutely. The airway issue is a different issue than I see for an anesthesia pathway. That makes sense? So that's what I'm looking at is that were the drugs reasonable? Was everything else reasonable? Then it goes that back to skill and technique and then managing the patient at that point. I guess that's what I was asking. That's
Mr. Diner, you got your hand up. Mr. Diner, yeah. Before I get to you, Eddie, I've answered a lot of these airway questions, and I don't want to step on your toes. Do you want to jump in on anything?
No, you've explained it very well, and I think pointing that out that when he was talking about resedating or, you know, basically trying to get that airway to relax so he can manage it and control it and ventilate the patient and then obviously oxygenate the patient. I was just had a couple questions for Dr. Lamb. At what point did you feel like it was a full laryngeal spasm? You know, oftentimes there's, you feel like the partial or, you know, just an obstructive issue. At what point did you feel like you had a full-on laryngeal spasm you were dealing with?
I never felt that it was actually a full-on laryngeal spasm. I mean, the pattern of breathing wasn't the typical high-pitched noise that you hear with the laryngeal spasm, and he wasn't bucking the same way. But it seemed like it was maybe even more supraglottic, hypopharyngeal area.
Okay. No, thank you. And what was the did they started CPR in the office? Did they initiate chest compressions in the office as well, Dr. Lamb, and who was part of that?
Yes, when the EMTs came in, you know, they put their monitors on. They checked the rhythm. They said it was in ventricular tachycardia, and I don't think they checked the pulse, but they started doing chest compressions. They inserted, I think it was a combi tube, is what they put in, and you know, they seemed to be ventilating him and oxygenating him at that point. And then eventually his rhythm did return, so they stopped chest compressions. But I don't know when it happened, but the combi tube came out and they were trying to do bag mask valve ventilation, and that just seems very ineffective.
What was what were his sats at any of those times?
I couldn't see their numbers on their monitor, but his color, he became cyanotic.
Okay.
Mr. Diner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Christensen, for those questions, because I was going to ask about, there was discussion about preparation and then to have an advanced airway established. And then the paramedics arrived, and the firefighters, in my experience, when they become licensed with whatever board they get licensed with, it's basically a high school degree and two weeks or 2 months of EMT training. So in that situation, I think, I mean, the better professional to handle that kind of an emergency is Dr. Lamb, not the paramedic. And I'm not sure that we can make Dr. Lam the cause of the bad outcome in this particular situation, because we don't know how the paramedics handled the situation, how the emergency room handled the situation, what condition the patient arrived in the emergency room. So there are many factors along the way. What was the commute like between the dental office and the emergency room? So there are all of those factors that during which time the patient was under the care and custody of someone who is not as professionally qualified as Dr. Lam. So that is another sort of concern in my mind, that, you know, it's easy to blame, you know, one person because that person is in front of us, but there are these other factors that we also need to think of in terms of, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda sort of discussion that we are having.
So what my opinion right now would be to mimic something that we have in the interim consent agreement where, and I'll make a motion and then let's talk about it if it may or may not go through, that we offer a disciplinary consent agreement with a 12-month suspension of the 1301 permit, during which time the licensee would take 24 hours in sedation and anesthesia, particularly a portion of those to be devoted to airway management and medical emergencies in the dental office. Once those CE requirements have been completed, if it's prior to the 12 months, I'd like to give the licensee an opportunity to come back in front of the board and present, and potentially the board could lift that suspension early. And this is based off of the discussion we're having today, our consultant's report, and our consultant's discussion today as well.
Dr. Hero?
Yes.
May we add pharmacology to the CE courses?
Sure. So, Ryan, should we break up? Well, let's do this. I've got a motion on the table. Would someone second it?
Goodman second.
Goodman second. So now we're in discussion. Ryan, do you want us to really break up that the categories within that 24 hours of CE?
Yeah, so unless it's all one thing, then I would break it up, because if it's going to be pre-approved, excuse me, it'll make it challenging for your, not Nishant, Dr. Nishant, the consultant, but a consultant that would review the courses to see if it matches what the board is wanting to get for compliance. So it's, I think it's best to break it up.
So I would say 4 hours in risk management because of the ACLS expiration, 4 hours in pharmacology, 12 hours in airway management, and another 12 hours in, you know, all things anesthesia and sedation related.
Goodman still second.
Discussion.
The anesthesia related, is that the emergency?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Medical emergencies in the dental office.
Okay.
If needed, I still second that too.
So I'm actually leaning in favor of a non-disciplinary, because I'm not seeing a consensus on the standard of care. But I know there is a motion on the table. I just wanted to express my views. Thank you.
You know, I think it's appropriate to express that during the discussion. My view again is that the standard of care is you need to be able to manage the airway of the patient that you've selected to put to sleep. And the inability to manage that airway led to the adverse occurrence, my opinion. And that's why I've elevated this to unprofessional conduct.
Now, Anthony, to just top tweak that just a bit, I think it led to the adverse occurrence, but we don't know if it led to the death. That makes sense?
Sure. Yeah, fair enough.
So that I just wanted to highlight that I think that's an important comment.
Fair enough.
And now that this motion is on the table, can we ask about priors?
Ryan, we've
I think we got to pass it.
Well, because Dr. Jarrow's motion included based on the consultant's report. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was already stated in a previous open meeting.
Yeah, I thought we established in the last meeting there were no priors.
Right.
So, and I don't even know that it would change anything I'm recommending at this point.
Dr. Hero, this is Christensen. So you're saying if he completed this within 3 or 4 months, he could request to come back to the board to have it reevaluated.
And the board could reevaluate it. And if we elect to lift the suspension of the permit, we could do so at that time.
Now he can maintain a 1303 though and have us outside nurse anesthetist come in and stuff like that.
So, you know, well, certainly you could have a dental anesthesiologist come in.
Sure.
Based on the pathways for sedation, I don't know. I don't have an answer to a non-dental anesthesia provider working with a licensee who has a suspended 1301 permit. Meaning, if you have a 1301 permit that's active and unencumbered, you can bring in a non-anesthesia dental provider. If it's suspended, he would probably have to apply for a 1303 permit. My motion is not preventing him from doing that.
1304 permit, Dr. Hero.
I'm sorry. Yeah, 1304 permit. Thank you, Eddie.
And I would just I'd caution to limit who can provide the anesthesia.
I'm not trying to limit it. I'm just saying from a logistics standpoint, from staying compliant with our rules, because his 1301 permit is suspended, he probably could not bring a non-dental anesthesia provider under that permit, so he would have to acquire a 1304 permit in order to do so, which we are not preventing him from doing that.
Okay.
He could even work with another oral surgeon. The oral surgeon could provide the anesthesia.
I just don't want to take away his whole livelihood because of...
Agreed.
You know, waiting for
specific. Agreed. But there's options.
Yes.
Okay, Ryan. Sherry, why don't we get a roll call?
Okay. Hero?
Yes.
Christensen?
No.
Dinar?
No.
Ogindi?
No.
Goodman?
Yes.
Moffitt?
No.
Morrow?
I'm going to go no.
Penna?
Yes.
Seaman?
Yes.
Beanstalk is recused.
So motion fails, 5 noes, 4 yeses.
This is Ryan. Ms. Moffitt, were you a no? I couldn't make that out.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yes, I'm a no.
Okay, thanks.
Would one of our no's make a motion?
Dr. Hewitt, do you want to make the same motion but make it non-disciplinary? And I don't think in non-disciplinary we can have a suspension of the permit.
We cannot. So the motion would be for a non-disciplinary order for all the same CE previously stated to be completed within 12 months.
Anthony, I'm going to give you one more suggestion on this.
Yeah,
one.
I was going to make a suggestion too, but go ahead.
Because the only thing that gets me is the 12 month and I would have cut back the CE a little bit. I think it was a little stiff. And then I would vote for the disciplinary action on it.
Okay. The other thing I was going to say is, you know, if the suspension of the permit is hanging people up, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to maybe not suspending it, but requiring some kind of proctorship for a period of time where, as he's utilizing it, it's kind of the same thing.
I think it's fine because, like you said, it's an airway issue.
Yeah.
And I think he needs to manage airway. I don't think it's a drug issue. I think it's an airway issue.
Okay,
so
I'll make a motion for a disciplinary consent agreement with 12 hours of continuing education to be broken up as in sedation and anesthesia to be 4 hours in airway management, 3 hours in pharmacology, and four hours in medical emergencies. That's 12, 4 hours in risk management because of the ACLS. With a 6 month suspension of his 1301 permit, which can be lifted prior to that if the CE is completed before that point. This is in addition to the regular triennial requirements, and it's based upon the statutory violations cited in the consultant report, and the discussion we're having here today.
I'll second that.
Motion in a second.
Now, the question that I have is, if someone came to us with their sedation permit and their ACLS lapsed, and if there was no death or anything like that, what's been the traditional, I know we take in each case individually and stuff like that, but is there anything in our rules that talk about, you know, anything like that?
Susie, are you on with us? Ryan, are you able to answer that?
Yeah, I would, not specifically. I don't think there's a history of this that gives any sort of barometer. And my opinion, and Rob can cut me off, but I think you should just keep it on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure there was nothing in our rules that said that you were suspended or if there's a cost or a fee or anything like that. Or
yeah, there's nothing in the rules specifically.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, so it's the difference in the motion. We're in discussion right now. Go ahead, Mr. Goodman.
Yeah, the ACLS, how big of a deal without a adverse outcome if it just was found on somebody doing anesthesia? How big of a deal is this? It's not like people unlearn how to save lives, but there's a reason that we have the training and the recurrent training. So I guess some perspective from those that do it.
Well, and again, I mean, sometimes the ACLS courses, you know, I don't know how much benefit there is when you take them, but I'll tell you this. He didn't have a current ACLS. He couldn't manage the airway and he had an adverse occurrence. So, and now we're recommending CE in airway management, which ACLS would have covered had he had it. So there might have been some benefit.
Yeah, the evidence definitely would have been better in his case if he could say, well, I just had the training, I followed standard training,
right,
versus I had a paperwork snafu and we didn't realize we didn't have it, which of course has its own challenges of, well, what else might not be organized or structured right? Okay, right. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Diner.
So I still am struggling with the disciplinary portion of the motion because from the testimony that we heard and from the materials that we have, it seems like Dr. Lamb was actively managing the patient. He was prepared to insert an advanced area. I don't know exactly what the terminology is. But he was prepared to do all of those things, but then the patient was taken out of his control by the EMT team that arrived at the surgery center. So in terms of standard of care, I think Dr. Lamb did everything that a reasonable dentist ought to have done in that situation. After that, the patient was not within the dentist's control, so I'm really struggling with the disciplinary part.
Well, and I think, Mr. Banner, that's where we disagree, is I think the standard of care would have been for Dr. Lamb to have properly maintained that airway. And when the patient started to desaturate, he would have regained it enough time that he wasn't required to have the paramedics there to try to take over. If you lose an airway, you should be able to reestablish it fairly quickly. And, you know, how quick did these paramedics come? I mean, certainly not faster than 3-4 minutes. You shouldn't have an airway loss in 3 or 4 minutes. So that's why I'm elevating it to disciplinary, because in my mind, the decision making might have been okay in that I need to gain control of this airway, but the ability to do so wasn't there, and that's what falls below the standard of care. It'd be like saying, I know the tooth needed a root canal, and I did the root canal. It didn't turn out right, but I made the right decision in doing the root canal. In his hands, he was unable to reestablish an airway, and he should have been able to do that. Mr. Goodman.
Yeah, I'm with Dr. Hero. I don't think us or maybe anyone on Earth will know what issues ended up causing the death of this individual. But the fact that we got to the point that 911 was who had to take over, and Dr. Lamb was stuck at that point. He had to give authority to them. Because we got to that point, we definitely have concerns about everything up until then. And had his continuation saved the life, that would have been better. But I think we need to worry about if Dr. Lamb continues to practice the same way without any involvement by us, then what is the risk to patients in the community? And right now it sounds like there could be a real risk for patients based on decisions made that day.
And Mr. Dinar, my thing, the ACLS matters. And if I was going to get my dental license again, I can't do it without having a CPR card. And they ask you about that. And if you let it lapse, you can't get your dental license. So you got to go take CPR before you get your dental license. So that was the other thing for me, is that there's protocol and procedure. That I think that's important. And that was one of the things that's really hitting me more than anything, is that we let that lapse. That's a key thing in order maintaining your permits and literally putting people to sleep. And if you can't manage it, and one that thing that the ACLS does is it helps us understand how to manage it. If there's been changes in the past couple of years, they add, take away, do different things. So that's that. And then the adverse thing that happened on top of it, that's what piles on for me.
Who discussed proctorship in that? Who had brought that
I had brought that up as well. But
in what context, Dr. Hero?
In the context of, you know, maybe in lieu of some of the CE, but right now what the motion is, it's for a disciplinary consent agreement with a 6-month suspension of the 1301 permit, 12 hours of CE and anesthesia and sedation that have been categorized out, and 4 hours in training. And that 6-month suspension can be lessened if he finishes the CE prior to that, if the board elects to lift his suspension. So let's go ahead and get another roll call, Sherry.
Hero?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Dinar?
No.
Ogindi?
Yes.
Goodman?
Yes.
Moffitt?
Yes.
Morrow?
Yes.
Pena?
Yes.
And Seaman is not here right now.
Motion passes, one opposed. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Lamb. Thank you, Mr. Goodwin. Does board members want to take a short break or you want to press on? Thumbs up to press on, thumbs down to take a break. All right. Let's keep moving on. Case number 2023-00072. Is it Dr. D'Souza or Dr. Souza?
D'Souza. My real name is D'Souza, but you can go either way.
Okay, great, thank you. I think I just saw your attorney here a second ago.
Yes, I'm here, Dr. Harrell.
Great, thank you, Mr. Hayden. You want to make an opening statement?
Absolutely. Thank you for your time tonight. I know it's a late evening, so we'll try to move this along for you as quick as we can. I apologize in advance if you're screaming children in the background. I have a 3-year-old and a very angry 5-month-old right now. obviously we'll be taking a slightly different approach with this matter than the matter that the board just addressed. As you know, we were able to cover a number of items, particularly some items from Dr. Caputo's report at our last board meeting at the end of March. One item that had come up that I did add a little bit of extra, research on top of for the benefit of the board was the item that we had discussed about an executive session to include counsel and Dr. Sosa as needed. I will tell you, I think a lot of what may be able to be addressed can avoid that. The one item I did want to raise to the board members is, to the extent there is discussion that was touched on in the last matter with regards to what else could have been done, causation issues, other things like that, that is where I would renew a request to go into an executive session, because I think given details of this particular patient's care, there runs a very high risk of the patient's identity being revealed, particularly other treatments, where the treatment took place, when the treatment took place, et cetera. So that is a concern with regard to patient privacy that I believe is a valid basis for executive session for discussions if needed at that point. My hope is that will not be needed today. Beyond that, I think at this point over the last few weeks, as time has passed since our last time together, Dr. Sosa and I have had a number of discussions. Wants to obviously reiterate his remorse at the situation that happened and obviously the tragic outcome. We did want to make note to the board that the patient's family has actually remained in contact with Dr. Sosa throughout this whole process, keeping him updated about certain items, discoveries, et cetera. Again, for example, not to be discussed in detail at this point, but it has been revealed, at least since the date of this patient's passing, that there were actually other conditions that he had not revealed even to his family that he may have been suffering from. And then there also may be other issues that were discovered during his treatment at the hospital following his dental treatment that may have had a significant role in the unfortunate outcome. With all that being said, I did want to note, Dr. Harrell made a note of this in the last matter, Dr. Sosa's willingness to provide the interim consent agreement. On top of that, as the board members may be aware, there was discussion at the last board meeting of not only a suspension of his 1303, but also a sort of period, I guess we call it a periodic suspension of conducting extractions or implant procedures. Those two items were not in the interim consent agreement that was signed in early April. However, due to the discussion that took place at the board and Dr. Sosa's accountability for all this, he has obviously refrained from doing any extractions or implant procedures since the date of our last board meeting. And obviously an amended agreement was provided this afternoon, which we returned as quickly as possible to the board so that you guys would have your complete record moving forward tonight. It's slightly different than the last matter. As you all are aware, I have instructed Dr. Sosa to limit his discussion as possible, given some of the sensitivities of other issues going on at this time. With that being said, he has requested an opportunity to make a statement to you all, against perhaps his counsel's better judgment and request. But I do think that that's something that may mean more to you all to hear directly from him than hear from me. And so I'd like to let him do that briefly if you wouldn't mind. And then we had a couple other closing items before we can turn to board discussion, if that's okay with you, Dr. Harrell, and the rest of the board members. Okay. Dr. Sosa, please go ahead and make your statement, sir.
So I want to make this very brief. I never expect to be on this situation. I want to apologize to everybody that is involved in this. Mr. Jefferson said, he recommended not to speak, but I think it's important that you hear from me. I was the one doing the work. I was the one responsible. even though I cannot change what happened, I will have that in my mind forever. I will always have the what ifs. What if I made some different choices or some different decisions? But we live with that every single day. Every single day we make decisions, and sometimes at the end of the day we think, oh, I should have done something different to some particular situation or some particular case. So I'm going to have to live with that. I want the board to know that I will try, I will do the best as I can to improve from this situation so it doesn't happen again with me. And it can be something of a opportunity for someone else not to go to the same mistake, the same issues. I've been dedicated my life, more half of my life, as a dentist. So that's what I do. That's what I am. And that's what I want to continue to be for the future. I apologize for having to be with you guys over here right now. Thank you for everything that you guys are doing and trying to help us as a, dental community.
You're muted, Dr. Hero.
Thank you, Dr. Souza. Mr. Hayden, we'll go back to you. And you're muted now.
I'm going to blame Ryan for all that. I think he just keeps shutting me down. I can't blame him. I think given all the circumstances, there are a few other items we just want to briefly address. I think it's in the best interest of all parties involved, not just the board, Dr. Souza, the patient's family, for this to be resolved as quickly and expeditiously as possible. As you all are aware, we had preliminary discussions, Dr. Souza and myself, about some options that we could possibly explore with regards to resolving this quickly for you and for him, to be honest. One of the main things is we wanted to make two options. We want to obviously make sure that we fulfill the board's charge with regards to protecting the public and the duty that it is set up to do. But at the same time, be cognizant of I believe it was one of the comments that was made. I thought it was Dr. Morrow, but I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth about the idea of also trying to maintain his livelihood. As you heard from Dr. Souza, this is what he does. This is what he's been doing for more than half his life. And though we understand the gravity of the situation, trying to find a resolution in which the board can feel safe in protecting the public while also not sacrificing Dr. Souza's entire livelihood. With that being said, unlike the last matter, we're not here really to debate a lot of Dr. Caputo's findings. I commend him on how he conducted the interview. I did so at the last board meeting. I'll do so again in his presence, so this way he can believe me. But the one point I do think is important is he did point out as a positive in a very negative situation, Dr. Souza's responsiveness, that recognizing there was an issue, addressing that issue as quickly as he could. And as we discussed at the last board meeting, actually, accompanying the patient to the hospital and I find it odd, perhaps you all don't, but after being requested by emergency staff to actually assist with aspects of the procedure once he was at the hospital, he didn't hesitate to do that, to do everything he could to try and assist. With that being said, I think maybe it may be beneficial, and I will obviously defer to the board, to maybe work in reverse. In the sense that unlike providing offers or potential resolutions, maybe going through the board's concerns first. A lot of those were expressed, by Dr. Harrow and others at the last board meeting, but really kind of understand where some of the concerns are in the hopes that we can reach some sort of amicable, essentially a consent agreement to try and satisfy all parties involved today.
Thank you. Before we jump into that, Dr. Caputo, just will you briefly give us an overview of the violations you found and any other input you want to insert, as you know, we appreciate you being here today.
Sure. So I really don't have anything to add. I fully stand by the report that I submitted to the committee. The issues that I raised as a brief summary were, one, the initial workup and assessment of the patient, where I think it was clearly identified by the information provided to the office that this was a cardiovascularly compromised patient. And I think that the patient was misdiagnosed and assessed by both the initial dentist that saw the patient and then transferred care to Dr. D'Souza because of his background in training and sedation. I also had concerns regarding how the medical consult that was obtained, which we seem to identify by the first treating dentist, how that was responded to by the cardiologist and then subsequently not followed by both dentists that were involved in this patient's care, but certainly specifically Dr. D'Souza. So I struggled with that is in terms of why get a consult if you're not going to adhere or follow what's in there, or if you don't agree with it, contact the physician to have a further discussion. I struggled with the decision to do the amount and length of treatment based on the cardiovascular compromise of the patient and possibly understanding that it should have been known based on that presentation that adjustments to the treatment plan should have been made. And then also concerns about the local anesthetic choices, not just because of what had been responded to in the medical consult, but also because of the actual treatment involved and the amount of local that was used to achieve anesthesia. And then certainly the deficiencies with the record based on what is required for a 1303 permit holder and that not being observed or followed, as well as some other deficiencies in the record. So that's pretty much my overview. I'm certainly open to questions that anybody may have, but that's kind of where I'm at, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Caputo. I had a couple questions for you. The first was regarding local anesthesia. He's a cardiovascularly compromised patient. Was the amount of local given appropriate given the cardiac complications?
So from a dosing perspective, you have two issues, right? You have the local anesthetic and then you have the epinephrine. If you just looked at the local anesthetics that were administered, they were within acceptable parameters. Where you have to determine where that was violated is that the medical consult said no to the administration of epinephrine containing local anesthetic solutions, and that advice was not followed because obviously local anesthetic with vasoconstrictor was administered to the patient. So there's a conflict, right? You have a medical consult that says one thing, and the practitioner did another. But purely from a dosing perspective, no, other than you were looking at, as I recall, 5 or 6 teeth that were being extracted, and they required 8 cartridges, I believe, of local anesthetic. I might question that just from my own background in how I teach dental students appropriate anesthetic selections and approaches to anesthetizing areas for profound local anesthesia. That would not have been a typical or recommended approach with that amount of anesthesia being administered.
In your opinion, Dr. Caputo, is Dr. Sosa proficient in working on medically complicated patients?
I would say at looking at this case alone, I would be concerned that decision making on his part wasn't appropriate for this patient. Example, he identified the patient as an ASA2. I provided the board with the ASA document, and it's clearly indicated that a patient who has an ICD in place is automatically listed as an ASA3 patient. And this was a particular patient who did not have an ICD in place, but was actually recommended to have it in place. So one might even argue that the patient could have been an ASA4 because of their presenting condition. Regardless, I think minimally, this patient should have been identified as an ASA3, and as a result, managed in a different way. One of the recommendations I made was, which literature does support, is having a separate and dedicated anesthesia provider present for treatment, or referring the patient to a location where that type of support is available.
Did you interview Dr. Souza regarding the utilization of another anesthesia provider?
I did.
And did he seem to have a understanding of how that dynamic works and what cases you would want to bring in a second provider for?
We didn't talk about the breadth of cases. We just talked about this case specifically. And I will certainly defer to Dr. DeSosa and Mr. Hayden to confirm if I have this correct. But as I recall, Dr. DeSosa's response to me when I asked about bringing in a second provider was that he offered that to the patient, and the patient did not want to have that service provided. And so the decision was made not to incorporate a separate sedation or anesthesia provider.
That's correct, Dr. Arrow.
Thank you. Can you comment, Dr. Caputo, on the type of oral sedation that was employed? I haven't seen a combination of drugs like that used to accomplish an oral sedation before.
So when we talk about, particularly with respect to the permit level, the practitioner is available to provide minimal or moderate sedation. In my review with Dr. DeSosa, his interpretation of what he does is minimal sedation. I discussed with him that though I wasn't there to actually see the effects of the drugs administered, I considered the amount of drugs administered, particularly in combination with a relatively high level of nitrous oxide oxygen at 45%. If you look at most references on nitrous oxide administration, the average percentage amount for appropriate sedation is around 30 to 35%. So even having a patient at 45% nitrous oxide oxygen sedation with a long-acting benzodiazepine and diazepam being administered, as well as three other medications being administered, to me, that's beyond, my interpretation would be that's beyond minimal sedation. Based on his assessment. His permit obviously allows him to do that, but it could have impaired decision making as well as patient response. Now, the challenge there is, even though I know you're not asking this directly, but I think indirectly, is that the fact that he didn't have a directed record to look at or document or identify other than just his observation of what was happening on his monitor could have impacted some of his responsiveness to that level based on that lack of documentation.
This is a hard question to opine on, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Dr. Caputo. Do you think this adverse occurrence could have been avoided had there been better decision-making along the way?
My overall assessment would be yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hayden, do you want to make any comments after that discussion, or do you want me to open up this to the board to ask questions and for discussion?
I think it's okay to open up to the board for discussion. I mean, Dr. Caputo pretty succinctly and accurately summarized our relatively lengthy interview that we had a number of weeks ago. So I think at this point, again, we are not here to argue about the nuances of Dr. Caputo's report. I will say I think it was eye-opening for my client, which is why we had made the initial offer that we did at the last board meeting, because I think it's sort of a little bit of a reset, at least from the 1303 perspective. And so I think at this point, Dr. I'll allow you all to open your discussion, and you know, I'm happy to answer any additional questions you may have.
Thank you. And I do want to thank you, Dr. Sosa, for signing that interim consent agreement. And like Mr. Hayden had said, it was the way it was originally written was inconsistent with the motion that had been made. And I know you were, I think, just today presented with the accurate interim consent agreement and signed it. And again, I think that cooperation shows your ability to be regulated. You know, obviously we have concerns, and I don't want to beat that to death because, you know, Mr. Hayden's made it clear you're not really here to argue on that, any of those points. So, I did want to just make sure the board is aware of your cooperation thus far, and we appreciate it. So I'll open it up to the board for questions or discussion. What I'll do, I'll start just to recap what the motion was at the previous board meeting and what now the current and accurate interim consent agreement reads is that there, Dr. DeSouza has agreed to not utilize his 1303 permit or seek or use any other kind of permit regarding sedation and has restricted his practice from performing any type of extractions or dental implants. In my mind, given the violations that Dr. Caputo's discussed along with the deviations that we can see in a consultant report, I would probably support a disciplinary consent agreement that is similar to that ICA. I don't know that we need to go down the road of a summary suspension, which this is agendized for. I would maybe foresee more of a practice restriction for some defined period of time in with the extractions and with implants, and a much longer restriction or suspension with any kind of sedation. That's kind of what's going on in my head right now, but I'd like to hear from everybody else.
Mr. Dr. Hero. Yeah, Dr. Hero, I, you know, of course, defer to the clinicians on this. I mean, this sounds like there's pretty grave concerns of the ability to practice as a dentist. Am I understanding that correctly?
There are some, yes.
Because when you start talking about a dentist not doing extractions, that would be in the realm of some of the easier procedures. Is that correct?
Well, I think there's two primary issues. The overarching issue here is clinical decision making. Okay, and then what specifically falls under that in this case? The preoperative assessment of a medically complex patient and the ability to safely administer sedation. So, you know, on the one hand, you can treat medically complex patients without doing surgery, without doing extractions, without doing implants. However, the larger cases, longer cases, oftentimes are the ones that are requiring surgery, extractions and implants, as this case was. That's why, to me, I'm thinking the public would be protected if there was a practice restriction in that area, and then to suspend the 1301 permit for a length of time, or the 1303 permit for a length of time, because I think there's real concern there. I think that, and however, so if you eliminated those two and you said, okay, he's going to do restorative treatment like fillings and crowns, you know, endodontic treatment, hygiene exams. Given Dr. Sousa's willingness to cooperate, I think there'll be a willingness to learn from this, to take CE, and to provide safe treatment in those other areas.
Yeah.
I made some assumptions, but that's just what my preliminary thoughts are right now.
I guess where my challenge is, haven't heard too many times that we've talked about limiting a dentist's ability to do extractions. I mean, it's quite possible Eve removed some of Adam's teeth for all we know, right? So as far as extractions, that should be some of the, and again, as a layman, isn't that some of the easiest work a dentist does?
No, I don't think so. I think okay. for a general dentist, the bread and butter, the most straightforward treatment is basic restorative treatment, exams, hygiene, things like that.
Oh, okay. But once you get beyond that, once you start treating the patient and extractions easier than some of the filling procedures, correct? Or again, not
when you really look at some of the complications that can come with it, okay. Especially on a medically complicated patient.
Okay. All right. Yeah, just trying to get some perspective. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I appreciate this conversation.
Mr. Goodman, I'm going to open it up just a little more too. Is if you are limiting the surgical components, it limits the advanced ability to treatment plan where you start asking for oral surgeons or prosthodontists or other people who are highly skilled in those things. And so I don't know if that's the practice restriction's fine. I don't think that makes him unable to do crown and bridge or anything like that, but anytime you're taking out teeth, you're dealing more with the person's medical than you are if I do a class 2 filling. So class 2 filling, there's no bleeding typically, and you know, you can handle that. Limited anesthesia oftentimes, anesthetics rather. So. And Apollo went right along with you. So.
Great.
And I guess, Dr. Hare, I have one question on the 1303 issue. So to kind of revisit our last board meeting, you know, one of our options we presented was actually not a voluntary suspension, but actually a voluntary surrender. And I guess, given my role as counsel in contexts such as this, I am not a, I guess, consultant with regards to licensure initially. I guess I'd have a question for you of, is it preferable for the board, if that is a primary concern, for my client to be suspended and then have to fulfill certain CE or other requirements over a period of time, whatever that time is, 6 months, 12 months, whatever you all decide is appropriate, or given he's already come to grips with that option that we presented. Obviously, I wouldn't be authorized to present it to you if he wasn't. Is it more preferable to voluntary surrender and then have to essentially start from scratch to obtain it? I guess it's an odd question it's odd for me to ask you that question, but I think if that's the primary area, I want to make sure that that is covered in a sufficient basis for members of the board. If there is a preference between a suspension for a period of time, with requirements to lift the suspension or essentially a voluntary abandonment and starting over.
Ryan, do you want to comment on that?
So I can, and probably Mr. Diner would be better to answer the question, but so the board basically has regulatory authority in both avenues that Mr. Hayden pointed out. One is he has to, Dr. DeSouza has to come back through a whole new application process. And then the other is that you would have control in compliance measures in order to get the suspension lifted. So either way, it's kind of that belt and suspenders, in my opinion. And so Mr. Diner, feel free to jump in, but I don't know that one way makes a bigger difference than the other.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in my mind, just the voluntary surrender sort of shows the licensee's desire to sort of, you know, be regulated by the board. And I would see that as a more favorable option from the licensee's perspective. Because, I mean, I think a licensee that realizes the gravity of the situation and decides to voluntarily surrender, I mean, you're basically just having to reapply at some point, and then you have to meet the requirements for an application for these permits. So that's the difference, really, is the suspension is the board just laying the number of months or number of years that the permit is suspended, or, you know, has the there's an inbuilt option in the suspension to have the licensee come back to the board and ask for an active permit. So that's really the difference. A brand new application versus the ability to reactivate a suspended permit.
And obviously, just to clarify, Dr. Hare and board members, if there was a desire to not be allowed to reapply for that period of time, six months, whatever it ends up being, I think that's something that we obviously can consider in our discussion, so that it's just to be abundantly clear that this is not in any way, shape, or form a nefarious proposal in which we voluntarily abandon it and then he reapplies tomorrow. Just so that everyone's clear on our, it is exactly as Mr. Dinar said, of trying to show the board just how accountable my client is trying to be given the gravity of the situation.
Well, and I appreciate you clarifying it, because that is part of my concern would be, you know, that we have a little control over that. And the reason being, I think there's a real opportunity for Dr. Sosa to learn through a proctorship where, you know, he took the courses before. There seemed to be a real lack of understanding from pre-op assessment to sedation utilization to medical emergencies the whole way through, at least according to Dr. Caputo and you know, my own review. There just seemed multiple errors in clinical decision-making along the way. And I worry that just retaking the courses may not provide enough that in this order, a proctorship as part of the, say, probationary time that allows him to understand sedation, allows him to understand medical emergencies, medically complex patients, preoperative assessment, all that, I think it would do him a service in the long run. Dr. Morrow.
Yeah, the only thing I'm thinking, Dr. Hero, is that if he chooses not to take the sedation certification again or whatever it is, he's not going to get that education and so forth. So we've got to put that into any agreement that we want to make sure that there's medical necessity and so forth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because he may say, hey, I'm good. I don't ever need to do IV sedation again, or I don't ever want to have to put anybody to sleep again, especially if you're not doing surgery and implants. But we still have the decision-making situations we've got to deal with, and the other aspects of just being a competent, you know, well-meaning dentist. So I don't want to eliminate that component by saying, sure, we'll go ahead and have him relinquish his certification and then may not ever come back to it.
Yeah. What's your thought on like a proctorship? Or Dr. Beanstalk, you know, I know it's with kids, but you do more oral sedation certainly than I do. Do you have an opinion on this?
I think a proctorship would be helpful because it's somebody watching and monitoring what he's doing and his decision making. And since decision making is the big concern here, I think that would help. I think just sitting in a CE course is one thing, but actually doing hands-on day-to-day patient management and patient selection makes a bigger impact on a clinician than just sitting in a CE course.
Ryan, could an order be written where there's a voluntary surrender, but if he was going to apply for a new permit, in addition to the regular requirements that he'd have to meet, you would have to undergo some kind of proctorship?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it would be up to his willingness to sign something like that.
And what I'm thinking is, and Russ, I don't know if this is what you were saying. My screen froze a couple times, but I don't really want to put an order in with a proctorship if Dr. Sousa decides, well, I just don't want to sedate anymore. I mean, then why are we making him go through this proctorship if that's not going to be something he wants to proceed down the road? So that's where that voluntary surrender and
if he ever wants to place implants or extractions again, I
apologize for interrupting, Dr. Moore. I think the practice, I mean, again, I don't want to miss here, but I don't think the practice restriction is permanent. So, you know, obviously he does want to do implants and extractions again with regards to whether that is going to be, something that, you know, can be done with others that have the ability to assist to the extent sedation, et cetera, is needed. But I don't think Dr. Sousa, and at some point he may, you know, these are some things that he may be able to answer himself for you all today, but I'm not of the understanding that he wants to limit his practice in perpetuity. But there is a willingness and an understanding that if there's a period of time in which a limitation is needed to comply with some educational requests by the board, he is happy to undertake that, sort of the idea of foregoing the short-term detriment for the long-term benefit of both himself and the practice. And so that's what that's the cooperation that we are trying to present to you.
Yeah,
all.
And Mr. Hayden, that was my line of thought as well. You know, a defined period of a practice restriction during which time certain CE requirements would be met. I was not thinking of any kind of practicership with the surgery component of it. I think that, you know, once some CE in the medically complex patient, medical emergencies, you know, that realm, once that's met, you know, the practice restrictions are lifted at that point.
And that was my thought too, Mr. Hayden, was that I didn't want to have a proctorship come in if it wasn't in the area that we're concerning. And the biggest concern, obviously, is the sedation. The secondary concern is the surgery. And I hope that he'd want to do the surgery again and all the other stuff that goes along with it. But I also think that is something that he can gain through CE and hands-on. But I don't necessarily think you need the proctorship with that CE and hands-on, because that'll happen. So in that.
I appreciate the clarity, Dr. Morrow. And as you guys can all probably tell at this point, our goal today is to find that common ground in which we are satisfying your concerns as far as education, training, development, while not putting, you know, Dr. Sousa's livelihood at risk, even temporarily, you know, sort of a complete,
I think the word here, Mr. Hayden, is reasonable.
You know,
reasonable.
It's a word that's thrown around a little bit too much in my profession. So we'll find some other fancy word in the dental world we can use instead of reasonable. Everyone loves being reasonable in law when no one's reasonable. So, you know.
And I'd hate to have undo unnecessary things, but, you know, part of protecting the public is Dr. D'Souza is also part of the public, and we want to make sure he's great and a great dentist and fulfills his obligations of everything that he does too. So I think that's on the forefront of our mind as well as the patients that he's seeing. So I think that's where we're all going on that. Mr. Dinar, I cut you off on that. Sorry.
And then Mr. Giger just jump in after Mr. Dinar.
I was just going to say I agree with what Dr. Hero said and what Dr. Mara said. I mean, in terms of a disciplinary order, I think I'm seeing a consensus if I'm reading the room right. On the terms that Dr. Hero mentioned. So if you want to take this forward, I'm all for it.
Mr. Goodman, any comments before we do that?
Well, in the desire to kick the hornet's nest, I really appreciate how penitent the dentist is and how much he's admitting that he should have done differently. I also don't know how much proctoring training or anything else can teach somebody that they have to follow what the consultant tells them to do when they're told don't proceed with this case. Somebody who would knowingly proceed when told that this person's heart wasn't prepared for the case, how do you protect the public in the future if the person's willing to do that, to make those kinds of choices? And I mean, how many cases do you need to know that he no longer will go directly against good medical advice? And so I have some reservations. I think it's wonderful how willing the dentist is to improve verbally today, but this case tells us that this dentist will go directly against the advice given, at least from what I'm understanding here today.
Dr. Caputo, you got your hand up. And Dr. Caputo, will you also comment? You had made a mention of another licensee involved in this case and a potential violation. I'm wondering if we need to open up a case to review that licensee's work as well.
My recommendation is that you do, and that's in the report. So I'll just let that speak for itself. The comment about educating and moving forward, I'll put my educator hat on. That's exactly what we do. What we want to do is help Dr. Sousa make better decisions and not necessarily treat this patient again, but identify that, hey, I should do some things first before I make any decisions about treatment. So that's the educational process. And that's very easy to do. A consultant or an educator doesn't take the position of this is what you have to do or you have to do it my way. What we do is we apply our knowledge to their specific clinical subset and say, how can we help you become a better provider and put mechanisms in place to facilitate that? And the biggest thing that you said at the very beginning of your comments, which I think were perfect, is if you have a licensee who is understanding and penitent and thoughtful about what has occurred, they're going to be very open to that educational process and improving themselves. So I think there's a huge opportunity here that would work really well in this type of situation. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the feedback. Okay. Appreciate it.
Well, to keep this moving along then, any specific thoughts on an amount of time for practice restriction with, let's start with the surgery and the implants? And Mr. Hayden, I'm not asking you this here.
I think it's the time restriction should be associated with the hands-on component, meaning that the education and so forth should be done first before we lift the practice restriction.
So we don't put a time on it. It's just whenever the CE is finished.
Until he's finished with the hands-on CE component.
So. It would be
with a minimum of, you know, 6 months or 3 months. You
can put a minimum. We need a minimum. So
yeah, you can put a minimum on it. But I think that has to be done before he goes and, you know, before we give him the keys to the car, we got to have him go through driving school.
And how about CE? How much are we thinking? Hands-on and non-hands-on. I mean, there should be medical emergencies in the dental office, medically complex patients,
risk management,
even see the medically complex patient portion. I mean, that should include pre-op assessment and diagnosing and treatment plan. And I mean, that needs to be robust. That in and of itself to me needs to be about 12 hours.
Yeah.
We also need record keeping.
And then there needs to be a hands-on oral surgery component that would be probably another 12.
And what about 4 hours of medical emergencies in the dental office? Because whether you're sedating or not, there is a failure to understand how to
treat. Sure.
Now with the sedation, so we would do a voluntary surrender of the 1303 permit, and if there was going to be Dr. Sousa was going to reapply for any permit, then we would require 40 hours of a proctorship hands-on clinically with a provider in a similar or higher permit level.
Above and beyond the requirements to receive the permit.
Yes.
Are we sure 40 hours is enough?
I was thinking 60.
That's 1 week.
Yeah. So, well, what are your thoughts? I was going to say 60, but Dr. Moore always beats up my length of time. Mr. Diner, you got a comment?
Yes. So on the voluntary surrender, I'm not sure we can order him to voluntarily surrender. I mean, it's an order to surrender. There is no voluntariness there. And the other sort of concern I have is, I like the proctoring idea. I'm probably leaning toward suspension for a number of months rather than surrender, because the problem is, as a reapplicant or as an applicant for a 1301 permit, we have our statutes, and as long as you comply with our statutory requirements for obtaining those permits, we have, you know, an obligation to issue those permits. So I'm concerned that it doesn't get us there by ordering a surrender of the permits, but it gets us there if we suspend the permits for a number of months and then have a proctoring requirement along with CEs and everything else that you said.
Yeah, and I agree. And that was kind of why I started off with suspension. It's cleaner in my mind. Mr. Hayden.
I actually would like to echo that, Dr. Hare. I think in sort of preliminary discussions, we had offered the voluntary surrender with the idea of sort of expediting the process. It sounds this may actually complicate it, particularly with the proctoring element that you raised today. So a suspension of the 1303 for a period of time during that suspension period in which there is the proctoring and the CE and other requirements, I think satisfies everyone a little better. It allows Dr. Sosa to do sedation again, hopefully in the future, which is his goal. But also allows the board to maintain control of how that training is done before the suspension is lifted. So to the extent possible, I'll take my own offer and throw it away and say that the voluntary surrender seems overcomplicated and some version of a suspension will work for us. And you won't be receiving an objection for us if we do it that way.
Great. Dr. Morrow.
One other thought on that, Mr. Hayden, would be if he does, because we could suspend it for a period of time, but require that there's all the extra proctoring and stuff. If he chooses not to do the proctoring and not to renew it, I don't think there should be a penalty against him either, like he's defying a board order.
I would agree with you on that, Dr. Morrow. And I think, in speaking to the extent I can for my client, it's something he wants to do. So I fully expect that if that's the particular order in the consent agreement, it's something he will comply with. But to the extent there's a carve out, which I'm sure, your counsel can handle no problem. To the extent he changes his mind and doesn't want to pursue the sedation permit renewal or lifting of the suspension, that I agree with you, and I appreciate that there wouldn't be a penalty for violating the board order for not continuing CE in a category he doesn't want to pursue.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So going back to the proctorship, do we want to do hours or do we want to do cases?
Hours.
Okay. So how many hours?
I'm okay with 60. It's fine.
I like 80. It's 2 weeks.
But you also have to remember that there's a cost that goes along with that. It gets really expensive very quickly, and it borders on unreasonable. Is kind of what I'm getting.
Because I'm less concerned with cost and more concerned with.
No, I get that, but the 80 is a lot. I mean, to do 80, that may take someone who doesn't do a lot of sedation a year and a half to get to that point.
Yeah, Ryan? Someone died.
No, I get that.
So I just want to – I've said this before, and I'm just going to reiterate it again. Based on the Auditor General's report, the number one goal of the board is to protect the public and that's it. So the interest of cost, and we're taking away somebody's livelihood and all of that, should never be taken into consideration. It's measured in weight, but your number one goal is to protect the public. And if you can protect the public by also rehabilitating a licensee, then that's great. But it should not be on the forefront of our minds.
Well, yeah, my thought on that was 20 hours is not going to change a whole lot on between 60 and 80. I was thinking 40, but.
Well, here's the other way to think about it. Say the average case is 2 hours when you're doing a sedation. So 80 hours would be 40 cases. You know, how long would it take to do 40 cases? You could do that very easily in a year.
Yeah, but to get the license originally, you need 20 cases.
So we're doubling it.
So it's double. It's appropriate.
And we can do an or. We can do this many hours or this many cases. It could be one of the two things meet the requirement.
All right, I'm going to make a motion. I'm going to make a motion. We can vote on it. So I'll make a motion that we offer a disciplinary consent agreement with a minimum of a 12-month suspension of the 1303 permit, and prior to that suspension being lifted, 80 hours of proctorship and hands-on clinical cases needs to be accomplished with a 1303 provider that has an unencumbered permit or higher. So a 1302 permit holder, 1301 permit holder, or combination of the three is acceptable prior to the suspension of the 1303 permit being lifted. In addition to that, we would put a 6-month practice restriction, during which time the licensee would be on probation, on with practice restriction in extractions of all kinds, and the surgical placement of dental implants, minimum of 6 months, with 8 hours of continuing education in dental treatment on the medically complex patient, 4 hours of continuing education with medical emergencies in the dental office, 12 hours continuing education, hands-on in oral surgery, 4 hours continuing education and risk management. This is all in addition to the regular triennial requirements, and it's based upon the violations cited in the consultant's report and the conversation that we're having here today.
Goodman, second.
How long does he have to get it done?
I don't know that we're putting a time frame on when it needs to be done, just that the practice restriction and the suspension of the permit are not lifted until they're completed.
But there are certain things that should be done quickly, like risk management and, you know, certain things that we need to make sure that there's an understanding about.
Well, I think the fact that he's got a practice restriction and a suspension would promote, it would certainly encourage him to try to accomplish these as quickly as possible.
But I agree, Dr. Morrow. I think we need a time limit.
But again, hypothetically, if he says, hey, I really don't want to deal with extractions again or implants.
Okay. Then within 12 months.
I think that's fine.
All right.
Goodman, I support that.
Or no, actually not within 12 months. It's at a minimum 12-month suspension and all of these conditions. And after 12 months, whatever is sooner. So let's say he completes all of the requirements in 6 months, the suspension still lasts for 12 months. So 12 months is the sort of minimum, not within.
Right, but Dr. Morrow and Dr. Penna's suggestion was to also make sure that the CE is being completed within a certain period of time. So the original motion just had those minimums. So we would still have a minimum 6-month practice restriction and a minimum 12-month suspension of the permit. But the CE needs to be completed within 12 months, regardless of those, I guess.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. Ryan, do you have all that, or does our attorney have all that?
Yeah, I have it all. I just wanted to make one clarifying point, and maybe Rob's going to write the order in this fashion. But there was discussion about after the 12 months, he may not even try to reinstate the 1303 permit. Do you want this reevaluated after 12 months? Because otherwise this order could go on in perpetuity.
Yes.
And I don't think you want that either.
Yeah, no, we don't want it. Well, we can review it. Mr. Polder.
Yeah, my question would be, and if I understand correctly, is just or unlikely write this order, is that he has 6 months practice probation on extractions and dental implants, correct?
Correct.
And then he has a minimum of 12 months, even if he finishes all the CEs and does everything and does the proctoring for his 1303 permit suspension. Am I understanding correct?
Correct.
Okay. I do agree with Ryan that you do need in your motion just to say this will be visited in 12 months to be reviewed. Because
okay.
You cannot have this open-ended. So if you have a minimum, so at 1 year from now, this will appear before the board to review and do whatever needs to be changed. So that way you have an end date that it comes toward the board.
Great. Yeah, I'll amend my motion to include that.
Amend the second.
Dr. Seaman.
I just had a clarification from my mind. So for the practice restriction part, does he have 12 months to complete this CE, or is that a 6-month completion?
Yeah.
So the restriction can be lifted after 6 months.
If he completes the CE.
If he completes the surgery CE, it can be lifted within six months.
The CE that applies to the practice restriction.
Yeah, so Mr. Polder and Ryan, you guys are going to kind of have to disassociate which CE goes with a practice restriction and which CE goes with the 1303 permit.
Okay, so I think that I understand to some degree, and I think the easiest solution is Rob will probably write the order, and then we'll have you guys approve it on May 12th and then offer it then. That way
okay,
you guys can take a look at it.
Do we need to state that the ICE is in effect until this is signed?
No, it's because that's the purpose of the ICA is until this. Yeah. So as long as we're working as expeditiously as possible, he's not on the ICA in perpetuity as well.
Okay.
I apologize. Just to clarify for timing, if there was 6 months, if Dr. Sosa is trying to obviously accelerate this and be able to restore his practice as quickly as possible, are we doing 6 months starting from now or 6 months starting a month from now at May 12th? So I think that's one clarifying point of the start date. The issue of the ICA continuing until the new one is signed, I don't think is necessarily an issue as long as there's sort of some potentially retroactive application of the time frame. It's just a month from now, so it, you know, kind of cuts into the time. So just want a little clarity on that.
So the ICA is still in effect, which is the extraction and implant. The new order would be in effect as of the effective date of the order, which would be the latter signature on the order. So D'Souza would likely be first, and then somebody from the board, either myself or a board member, would be the last one. But it's usually within a day or two after you sign it. And that would be the effective date of the order.
Correct, but it sounds like we're not even going to have an order to be signed for another month.
Yeah, and I don't understand the challenge there.
The challenge is if he's restricted for 6 months, that's what we're talking about today, it actually equates to 7 months if we don't get...
I mean, if he... I think the challenge would be that there's CE laid out that he has to do to lift the restriction. If he does it sooner, it gets lifted sooner. A lot of this is going to fall on him. It's not a minimum of 6 months. It's a minimum of 6 months unless he completes certain CE to lift those restrictions.
Okay, I apologize. I heard that differently, that it's 6 months no matter what. If he finished CE in a month, it's still 6 months.
You know, Mr. Hayden, I think you're right. I think our motion and conversation was that it is a minimum of 6 months. So, Ryan, even if he completes it in 2 months, the practice restriction isn't lifted until 6 months, based on the board discussion. Was that?
Originally, that's what you did say, but then somebody brought up the fact that that Rob and I have to delineate which ones are related to the 6 month practice restriction and which ones are related to the 12 month permit suspension, and that both could be, or the 12 months is the only one that I knew was a minimum for the anesthesia permit, but the 6 months could be lifted if you did the CE in time.
Mr. Diner?
So just to sort of prevent overcomplicating these things, I think it's and again, my memory can be failing because it's late in the day, but the 6 month practice restriction is just a 6 month practice restriction from the date of the signing of the agreement. And that just makes the most logical sense in my mind. Because I mean, I understand sort of like the good time credit sort of a concept where, the agreement isn't signed for the next 20 days. And then, you know, is it really 5 months and 1 week? I mean, that's just too much math for everybody. It just is easier 6 months from the date of the agreement in my view.
Great. Let's do that. And we can review it on May 12th. All right. Sherry, can we get a roll call, please?
Yes. Hero?
Yes.
Beanstalk?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Dinar?
Yes.
Elgindy?
Yes.
Goodman?
Yes.
Moffitt?
Yes.
Morrow?
Yes.
Pinna?
Yes.
Seaman?
Yes.
Motion passes, not opposed. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Hayden.
Appreciate the time today, folks. Thank you very much.
Okay, Board, I am sorry, but we had to add one more item. You can blame Ryan. We're under a time crunch, and it couldn't wait until the next meeting. Agenda item 4, notice of final rulemaking. Ryan, very briefly, give us a recap. Mr. Dinar, please weigh in, and then we can vote.
Okay, so this is actually a bear in my sight since I've been here. This is the notice of final rulemaking for dental therapy. It went before GERC. Prior to going before GERC, Arizona Oral Health Coalition stated that their public comments didn't go before GERC. Make a long story short, a super long story short, they did go before GERC, but as part of another notice of rulemaking related to continuing education. And if you read their comments on the very last page of their comments, which is page 955 of your packet, they bring up the cultural competency again related to dental therapy and CE and taking courses related to cultural competency. The problem is they were not submitted again with the dental therapy notice of final rulemaking to GERC, and therefore GERC did not see it as a part of that package for dental therapy, nor did they see the board's response. And with that, all we need today, and Jessica's on and she can help possibly, poor Jessica, she's got two young children at home, as does a lot of people, I understand. And so if you need more procedural questions, you can ask her. In addition to that, Mr. Dinar sat both on the rulemaking committee for the board that was established by the board for the many months. In fact, he's the last board member present during that, where they've reviewed all of these comments. And they took into consideration tons of comments, not just by the Oral Health Coalition, but several other people. And then ultimately, what begins on page 913 in your packet is what the board voted to approve to go to GERC. I don't have any further summary than that, but Mr. Dinar, if you want to weigh in, feel free.
And Mr. Dinar, to me the question is, you guys met, you discussed all this. Has anything changed based on the comments from the Oral Health Coalition, or would you support what was originally proposed?
Right. So, yeah, that's exactly the question. I mean, we just need to make sure as the board that we are considering this particular comment. And my view is nothing really changed. I mean, for example, there are four issues that the comment raises in the rules group. Say the first issue I was in favor of, the second issue I was against, the third issue I was against, the fourth issue I was in favor of, but, you know, the rules committee decided what it decided, and we considered exactly these same issues in the rules committee, and the same issues were considered by the school board when it decided to vote on the rulemaking package. So at this point, we're just confirming that. We did consider these comments. They didn't sort of fall through the cracks, and we need to send this back to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council.
Great. Thank you. I agree. Would you make a motion for us, Mr. Diner?
Yes.
Oh, Jessica, you got your hand up?
Yes. Thank you. Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. So just for clarity, because I think that's part of what GIRC will be looking for. There were, I think, several issues that were raised in the most recent letter from the Oral Health Coalition, two of which I believe the board has already addressed and which were presented to GIRC, which is the cultural,
cultural competency.
Thank you, Ryan. Cultural competency and then also the tribal law issue, both of which I think have been, for lack of better words, put to rest. There were also three other very specific issues, and that was removing the requirement of transcripts being required under Rule 206B5, the reasoning being that transcripts are not required for licensure by credential for dentists or hygienists. The second issue, removing...
Jessica, can I stop you right there? Because it helps to sort of take it issue by issue.
Sure.
So the explanation, I think, I don't want to speak for the full board, but at least in my mind, the explanation for that was we eventually want to have the same kind of transcript requirement on the other professionals licensed by this board. And the reason was a few years ago we had the case of the dentist faking the 1301, the sedation permit. That was a big deal, right? The media, everyone probably remembers it. The Dr. Goyle case. So because of that, we eventually, I think, want to have the institution, the educational institution, send the transcripts to the board. We don't want the dentist to just submit, you know, some certificate that they have a doctorate in whatever. So this is really the first step in getting there. Now that we have a chance of making rules for therapists, we are putting it in there. We will eventually get permission from the governor to do rulemaking and have the same provision for dentists, denturists, and the fourth profession. Hygienists, sorry. so that's sort of the reason in my mind.
Thank you. That is actually very helpful because that is part of what will go into the final rule package that goes before GIRC. Okay, so the second issue was removing Rule 1602 because there may not be clear statutory authority to restrict direct supervision of dental therapists. And I believe that the committee also discussed this, but I wanted to make sure that the board was specifically addressing this particular comment.
Yeah, so on that issue... I actually am in favor of striking it, but I know that the rules committee, I was in the minority on that, and obviously the board allowed the direct supervision part to be in the rules. So in terms of the in terms of the position of the Rules Committee, it was viewed as sort of a regulation of the dentist, of the supervising dentist, because of just the, you know, physical limitations. You can't supervise more than a certain number of people actively or directly. That was the, so it wasn't a restriction on the therapist. It was more a signal to the supervising dentist that they can't directly supervise more than three therapists providing these services. Now, my personal view is the statute is clear. I mean, the statute gives the therapist, I mean, the scope of practice of the therapist is to do all of these procedures, and there isn't any numerical restriction in the statutes for direct supervision. So my personal view, which was overridden, was that this should be stricken. But I think to the extent that GRC needs an explanation, the explanation from the rules group suffices, I think, for our purposes. But again, I mean, this board can reevaluate that, I suppose, in light of this comment. But so I don't want to foreclose that, but I'm just sort of trying to move it forward.
Thank you. Again, also perfect for putting that in the rule package. All right, last one, removing 1601B and C because statute does not appear to require a dental therapist to complete specific courses in order to administer nitrous oxide or perform suturing and suture removal within the scope of their dental therapy practice.
So, on that issue, again, I was in favor of striking B and C, but again, that view did not prevail. The explanation in the rules group was that these specific procedures, while they are within the scope of practice of the dental therapy license, they are more invasive than the other listed procedures, and therefore we need to ensure that the licensee is meeting the requisite qualifications. So it's not so much an additional sort of qualification licensing requirement. Rather, it's just a check to ensure that the people who are licensed as dental therapists are actually trained to perform those specific procedures, given the invasive nature of those procedures.
Thank you. With that, now I believe, and Ryan or other board staff or any AGs who are on the line, feel free to correct me, but I think we're just looking for whether the board agrees with the determinations of the committee or if they would like to make a different determination.
That's exactly it. So you guys can now decide whether or not to go with the committee's recommendation, or Mr. Diner did a good explanation why he was the, I don't even know that he was the sole outlier, but he had good arguments for the other two issues. So you could do that and make those changes if you want. The two regarding cultural competency and the federal law regarding tribal land have already been addressed multiple times, so I don't think those need to be addressed again. But the other, I think it's four, would need to be. You basically just have to have a vote now.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Addie. Addie, you want to make a motion?
Yeah, so I'll make a motion that we approve the rules package for, let me get the articles right, for Chapter 11, Articles 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 12, 15, and 16 pertaining to dental therapy. We approve that rule package and we forward it to GRC for consideration with the additional information that was discussed in today's meeting in addressing the letter comment from the Arizona Oral Health Coalition.
Harold will second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, none opposed. All right. We can adjourn this meeting. Thank you guys so much. I know this was a late one, but necessary and appreciated.
Good night, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Hero.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Good night, everybody.